Blog Talk Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show. I cannot believe that it is April already. Where is this year heading? Who knows? Anyway, we have talked for the last several weeks about the phone calls on the various flights and have picked out some of the anomalies and some of the weirdness that really led Rebecca to all of her research and many of the conclusions that she came to. And we hope you've enjoyed that. I think the feedback that we've received has been very positive, and people have liked what we've had to say and have understood what we've had to say, and really it has made a great deal of sense. But there's so many things associated with 9/11 and the anomalies that pertain to all of the aspects of it that we thought we would do this show and maybe one or two more depending on how far we get with that. And so we're going to be talking about the anomalies, but before we do that, let me present to you Miss Rebecca Roth.
Oh, thank you. What a nice introduction. Well, it has been quite the interesting set of shows we've done recently, starting with the anomalies that I noticed from the flight crews not following the FAA hijack protocol that was available to us on 9/11. And actually, it had not changed for over 30 years. So the code words and all of the step-by-step protocol were not followed, which led me to believe that what I was looking at when I started to look into 9/11 as a flight attendant of 30-plus years was that it was not a typical hijacking. And so what we're going to talk about today, and as Ramjet said, we might even do two or three shows about this because besides the anomalies that I saw and the failure to follow, these were really set in stone protocol from the FAA for hijacking procedures. Now, one of those being, of course, we would not be allowing any passengers to get up and help. And that was one of the common strategy, it was called. Excuse me. So we're going to talk about some of the other anomalies that were kind of circling around 9/11, and I think you'll be amazed, and you'll probably feel like me, if you don't already, there is no such thing as a coinkydink, a coincidence, I mean.
Well, let me just start by relating something that happened to me here just this last week. I turned on the television, which I don't do very often. And lo and behold, whatever news organization, they were interviewing Donald Trump on his airplane. And his airplane was, of course, a Boeing 757. And I wasn't paying any attention at all to what the interview was asking or anything that Donald Trump was saying. All that came out to me was the background noise of those two jet engines that was constant over anything that anybody had to say in that interview. And I'm thinking, I never heard any of that on any of the phone calls. And it's very distinct. It's very prominent. It's not something that you could run into the bathroom and not hear, or go into first class, or even hide under your seat. It is pervasive throughout the entire aircraft. And I just thought to myself, bingo, bango, bongo. There you go. That wasn't present on any of the phone
Right. calls. And you'll remember, if you look into this through historycommons.org, The Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson, which is a book that I had my fictional character, Vera Hansen, receive so that she could start to understand what happened on 9/11. And quite frankly, one of the things that really struck me as a flight attendant was especially those on the receiving end of the calls, especially on Flight 93, that was supposedly at 39,000 feet and had been in the air nearly an hour when the phone call started to be supposedly made by mostly passengers, later on to crew members. And again, we have a situation where we have, I think, five crew members on that aircraft. And for 40 minutes or so, we've got passengers calling people, supposedly. And the flight attendants don't really call anyone. And then when they do, they make the ultimate boo-boo. And they make the boo-boo, which is calling home. And that's not where a flight attendant who is highly trained in FAA protocol would call. So, again, we saw these anomalies. So we're going to talk about some of the crazy stuff. And if you have not heard that interview, this was an interview put on by a Fox affiliate, I believe, out of Phoenix. And it's on YouTube. And it is, it's called something like an impromptu interview with Donald Trump. He's on his jet. They're in front of him. And you can see a screen behind that's giving flight information, much like you'd see on a commercial aircraft. It's like a TV screen put in the wall, but you can see it's flight information and a map of where the plane is, etc. And you can hear that on the YouTube, and you will hear a like a buzzing sound almost. And so those people that were receiving phone calls, remember they all said, it was so quiet. I didn't hear any commotion. I didn't hear any sound of jets. It was so quiet. It was as if they were in the room next to me, some of them even said. So we didn't hear any of the jet sound, which, of course, got my attention. Because you would. And like Ramjet said, you couldn't go into first class. You couldn't go into a lavatory. You can't go into the cockpit. That sound is always going to be there. So if you have an iPhone or one of those smartphones that does a microphone recording kind of thing, you can try that the next time you fly. And when you get on the ground and play that back, I bet you'll hear a sound that is the jets. Now, keep in mind, their aircraft at one point into several of the phone calls at 937 to 939 started a descent from 42,000 feet down to 19,000 feet. That's a huge, rapid descent, 6 to 10,000 feet per minute. So the aircraft would have been shuddering. It wouldn't just be like flying in smooth air like you heard on Donald Trump's plane. So that keep that in mind also. And it's a very scary thing. So you would have been hearing people scream. So anyway, these were the little things. And so we're going to talk about some other things that just plain don't make any sense. So we call them anomalies. And these are just things for you to ponder about 9/11. So,
well, the first one that comes to my mind is the fact that the 9/11 hijackers that went through Boston decided that they were going to go through Portland, Maine. That makes absolutely no sense at all. If you're planning this hijacking attack for 5 years, and this is the pinnacle of your deviancy, why in the world would you go through Portland, Maine, and risk missing the flight, which they almost did?
Mm-hmm. Well, here's something else about that particular item. After my first book, Methodical Illusion, came out, I got contacted by lots of American Airlines flight attendants and pursers. And you know what they told me just shocked me. Absolutely. And I would have put this in my first book had I known this. That when you fly a lot as a passenger, you can get put into categories and you use your mileage card. Mohammed Atta was a million-mile customer on American Airlines. And when, if you've ever flown to become a gold, platinum, silver, or million-mile customer, whatever each airline calls them a little bit different, but when you get into that million-mile customer range, you get lots of nice perks. And one of those perks is that your luggage would never, ever, ever, ever be left behind. And Mohammed Atta's luggage conveniently didn't make the exchange from the Portland flight, which he barely supposedly made the connection from the Portland flight to his flight to Los Angeles on Flight 11. So I'm here to tell you that when you become a million-mile customer on any airline, you get a luggage tag. And that luggage tag is like, oh, sometimes it's brass or sometimes it's got a certain color or signal or something, but all of us employees know what it means. It means that you are a million-mile customer, and we will bend over backwards. I remember times where, because someone had a short connection, maybe bad weather somewhere, or a mechanical on their incoming connecting flight, million mile customers, and they ran on board the last minute just like Mohammed Atta did. And right behind him would come a luggage handler from the incoming flight that says, hey, this is Mr. So-and-so's flight bag or his luggage, his carry-on or his luggage, even sometimes a larger suitcase. They had already closed up the baggage area downstairs for the flight. The flight was basically closing up. But since this guy was a million-mile customer, we would accommodate his luggage somewhere, even if it was inside the cockpit, strapped down with the pilot's luggage or in one of our closets where we'd put our stuff.
So what you're saying is that I could be sitting on an airplane and a million-mile customer comes in at the last minute with his suitcase and they throw me off the airplane to strap his suitcase to the seat that I was sitting in.
No, but it would go underneath a seat if there was one available. And if there isn't, luggage space, or like sometimes on flights now, I flew mostly 747-400, so, or the larger aircraft, and the luggage areas underneath the seat in front of you or the overhead bins can get full if your flight's full. So in that case, we would find accommodations in the galley or in the closet or, like I said, in the cockpit with the pilot's luggage.
Now, would they hold a flight in order to get somebody in that status's bags on?
Listen, when you're in that status, it's on all of the manifests, so people know if you are coming in from a connecting flight. And you're a million-mile customer, it's written there. And, you know, this is another thing. On the supposed fake manifests that were released by the FBI, there is never a word mentioned that Mohammed Atta, who all the flight attendants knew, was a million-mile customer, and it would be included. Just like if you were, if you're a vegetarian, or you're traveling with a service dog, or you're an unaccompanied minor, or you're traveling with your own personal oxygen, or if you need a wheelchair once we land, all of that's written on the manifest. It's not just a list of names. So when you see the manifests that they claim were the real manifests, you know they're not real because none of that information is there. And like I said, one of the first things that would be there for Mohammed Atta would be that he is a million-mile customer and probably have his number there.
And he strictly gets treated differently.
Oh, exactly.
They practically salute somebody like that.
Well, exactly. And if you're sitting in business, he would be put in first class if it's a three-class aircraft. And on a lot of the transcontinental flights, at that point in time in the airline history, some airlines had three classes, coach and a business class and a first class. So depending upon, let's say he gets on and he's got a business class ticket and there's a seat open, he would be put in the empty seat in first class. That is the kind of stuff that a million-mile customer would get, among other perks. But their luggage definitely would make it. So when I learned that from the flight attendants and pursers from American Airlines, I went back and I looked with a new set of eyes because I'm like, wait a minute, none of this makes any sense. And the fact is there is no explanation whatsoever why he would go to Portland, Maine, and then come in with such a tight connection into Boston when this was the new Pearl Harbor that was planned to be this huge event.
Well, it makes sense to me now why he did that, because they needed his luggage not to make it so that we could open his luggage and find out what he had in there, which was all a plant.
Right. It was all a plant. It was flight manuals. It was his will and testament. It was, all stuff that was meant to be found. Much like we talked about in the phone calls from Flight 93, Flight 93's phone calls really were meant to grab our emotions as Americans, to make us all feel like, oh my God, that woman is just like me, or just like my kid's teacher, or that woman is just like my neighbor, my librarian, or my doctor. And so you got these phone calls, but like I said, and the key factor, Flight 93, was that the passengers weren't really talking about hijackers so much as, referring to these people, whoever they had, or a problem on the plane.
Well, the other thing I've noticed when I've flown is when you have these types of classes of passengers on the plane, you know they're somebody special because you know they're being treated differently than you are.
Right.
And so as a passenger or somebody that's sitting around them, I mean, you even know their name because they come on, they would say, Mr. Atta, can
yes,
I get you,
exactly.
you know, whatever. And so if I were going to call somebody on my cell phone, quote unquote, I would say, I know exactly who this guy is
yeah, exactly.
because of,
uh-huh.
of the experience that had gone on around me.
That's true.
And that never happened.
And also the flight attendants and coach also given a copy of the onboard passenger manifest. That's a list of names and special services. If you're a million mile customer, platinum customer, certain airlines have, you know, certain names that they call you when you get to a certain rank of mileage. So that's in there too. If you're vegetarian, if you have any special needs in route, if you're a diabetic and have ordered a diabetic meal, it's something that we look at. And usually as the lead flight attendant, what we do is because we get several copies of those. And one of the things I would do is I always traveled with a red pen and I would circle those. And sometimes I would go back when I'd bring that paperwork back to the flight attendant's working coach and talk to the people to make sure that they hadn't changed their seat. And if it's especially a diabetic, that they were doing okay, that they hadn't been rushing all day from flight to flight and hadn't had any food and were about ready to have a blood sugar problem on board. So these are the things, and this is the reason why we have that kind of information in the passenger manifest. They are not just lists of people's names and seat numbers. There's a lot of other things. It's a lot of times where they're connecting to later and that sort of thing, too. So this is just stuff that when I started looking really closely at this, I saw so many anomalies. But off the flight attendant anomalies, there was a lot more things, too. I mean, now, another thing that happened that I found really interesting is on Flight 11, Amy Sweeney, she said that there were four hijackers. She might have said three. And yet on that same flight, Betty Ong said it was just one person called a he. She referred to the hijacker as a he. He stood upstairs. He has pepper spray or mace. And then the original official story claimed there were five hijackers on. And this is the type of information that a flight attendant would have been taught and trained to say if you could have been making a phone call or you were giving your information the way protocol was to the cockpit. You would want to tell them exactly how many people were, how many hijackers were on. Was it one he, like Betty Ong said, or was it three or four, like Amy Sweeney said? So you see there's an anomaly there, and that information is extremely important that it's real and it's true.
Well, when you do your division, your gazintas, I mean, you know, how many gazintas, 19 goes into four planes and 19 hijackers, you're going to have a minimum of four. Now, maybe if you had three on one, then you'd have six or seven mm-hmm. on the others. And so it just didn't ever quite, the math that you got from the phone calls mm-hmm. never worked out to align with what the official story was.
Exactly. And on Flight 11, for two flight attendants, this is a jumbo aircraft, so this is holds around 200, 230 people, depending upon the seating arrangement and the airline. And they're 150, 159 feet away from the cockpit and away from first class and away from where the hijackers supposedly are. One or two curtains between them and the action. And so they're back. They're giving information that's misleading and it's not the same as both these flight attendants are giving different information. There was somebody stabbed. There was a doctor. There wasn't a doctor and that sort of thing. But it's interesting, too, that the characters, two of the hijackers, I think these guys were on Flight 11, but I'm not positive. But Sayed Al Ghamdi is a Saudi Airlines pilot. He is still alive, by the way. Abdulaziz Al Omari is an engineer from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He was furious, and he is still included in the Wikipedia as one of the 19 hijackers. He's still alive. He's never been, I believe he had never been to the United States. But the FBI posted all of his personal details when they decided he was the hijacker, or one of the hijackers, including his name, his place of birth, and his occupation, which certainly matched his own story, but it wasn't him. He was at work as an engineer. So, again, now we have 10 of the hijackers. 6 showed up immediately within a week and a half of 9/11 alive. We have the Saudi Arabian government offering to sue the FBI, and that case just absolutely disappeared, suspiciously enough. I don't know if there was a payoff or what, but these men, there are now 10 of them that we found alive, are going to go down in history as one of the 19 Arab hijackers. Now, later on, the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, and I think Donald Rumsfeld even admitted this too, that, well, maybe they made a mistake and there was some mistaken identity, but they've never fixed it. So these guys are still flying around. There's 3 or 4 of them that are pilots for Air Tunisia, Saudi Air. I think one is with Moroccan Air. And they're still alive, and they're still going down in the history books as one of the 19 Arab hijackers, and miraculously, they're still living and still flying. So, anyway, let's get back to some of the other crazy things that were going on about some of the things that were really crazy leading up to this. Not only did they have just no connect time on the first Flight 11, but...
Well, the other thing is, you know, and we talked about this before, about in Boston Airport, the video cameras and the fact that there weren't any video cameras. But there were video cameras in the other two airports, in Newark and in Dulles. And yet there are no pictures of these guys anywhere. Now, you look at what happened in Belgium here this past week. I mean, within minutes, you had pictures of the suspected terrorists.
Yes, but one thing I noticed, an anomaly on the Brussels event, the security cameras were up in the ceiling, and all of the ceiling tiles fell down. Remember, it's a real high ceiling in that part of the airport. They're really high. It's like 30 or 40 feet high. So we had all these ceiling tiles come down, but we're led to believe that a security camera captured a picture, but there's no date or timestamp on that security camera. So what good is it? Now, if you're going to go back and look into a camera, what good does it do you if you don't know what day that was or what time it was? So most security cameras have a date and timestamp, which brings me back to Flight 11's hijackers. There is a picture, and there is only one picture of, they claim, Al Omari, which is, he's still alive, and Mohamed Atta. Going through security, they claim, at the Portland airport. Problem with that is there's 2 different time and 2 different date stamps on there. So which is it? Is it I mean, did they put the 9/11 morning date stamp on there later? I mean, that's just crazy. And it's also so blurry, you can't tell who they are. They could be someone that sort of looks like them, sort of. Because, you know, people in the Middle East, it's real hard to tell if somebody from Jerusalem, for example, is an Arab or is a Jew. It's almost impossible, especially in a grainy security camera. So that's something to think about. Because I've actually seen people that really look a lot like Mohamed Atta that are still here. So, you know, everyone in Israel plays army for a couple of years with Israeli Defense Forces. So it's just an anomaly, again, where it's impossible to believe. But, you know, like the Brussels thing, one of the things that caught my eye is they immediately tagged 3 guys, well, again, with no date or time stamp on the camera. That could have been a picture that was taken because, by all rights, that security camera was more than likely destroyed in that blast. That took the ceiling panels down much higher away than the security camera probably
was.
Well,
but even if it had relayed the pictures to another location, the point is they were able to produce something. And in 9/11, maybe they learned from 9/11 that, you know, you've got to have pictures. So, you know, they've got pictures. But there were no pictures anywhere with all of the security aspects that they had in place in Dulles and Newark. And I find that just really, you know, kind of strange.
Well, it is strange. It's like a lot of other things that are just really strange anomalies. another thing that, you know, just kind of off the cuff that I think about as a flight attendant is the fact that the military allowed these aircraft to be up there flying around. Now, Flight 93 was actually up there for quite a long time. Flight 77 as well. And the fact that the air traffic controllers, and now it's interesting too, because the Boston Center air traffic controllers, they coincidentally also had worked some other flights like TWA 800, Egypt Air, was it 990, I think it was, and some other interesting accidents or mishaps, airplane mishaps, I guess we could call them.
Well, if you're going to talk about the military response, another thing that really sticks out is the fact that if these guys were planning these flights to go into the Trade Tower, why in the world would they have come from Boston? Under normal circumstances, if you have a hijacking scenario, you're going to have response from NORAD in, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 minutes. And the flight from Boston to New York is long enough to where, you know, that would cause them a problem. You would think that they would have had the planes take off from Newark and fly into the trade centers.
Exactly.
But they didn't do that.
It's right across the river. And they wouldn't have been that high. It's pretty odd. Because keep in mind, on Flight 11, they were in command, supposedly, of the airplane, had actually landed the aircraft so phone calls could be made within 18 minutes. And so within a very, very short period of time, we were led to believe that. So whether it was, it was remote control. So they could have taken over that aircraft from on the moment it took off out of Newark. Or same with Dulles. Now, the plane that left Dulles, which is another weird anomaly, is it took off and it flew, I forgot how long it's flown now, it took off at, I think, around 8 o'clock. And it flew for almost 40 minutes. And Dulles is right across the river from the Pentagon. Why would anybody who understood that our military, in normal circumstances, if it were not under some kind of control of the perpetrators, normally they would scramble jets within moments of that of anything abnormal going on. I mean, absolutely anything, whether the pilots squawked 7500 on their radio or whether they heard somebody screaming from the cockpit or, you know, some anomaly. They were without radio, which was the case. Boston Center thought Flight 11 was experiencing a mechanical delay that, quote unquote, affected their radios because they couldn't contact them. Of course, when the flight termination system remotely takes over the aircraft, remember, they lose all ability to communicate. So they lost their radio and the ability to communicate. So, but, you know, nobody had reported a hijacker, and the pilot certainly didn't have a hijacker in the cockpit. So they probably had no clue that they had been taken over remotely by the flight termination system. Or as American Airlines called it, according to the people who have contacted me, they refer to it as the flight interruption system. So they actually gave it their own company name.
Well, the other thing about the military response is those military jets that would have intercepted this, you know, they're probably F-16s or, you know, F-14s. They had the ability to fly at Mach 2.5, maybe Mach 3. And, you know, it's three times the speed of sound. And yet these planes that eventually did react to this, hours late, you know, we're flying at just their normal cruising altitude, you know, not trying very hard not to break the sound barrier. Now, you know, they don't want to break the sound barrier when they're over, populated areas. But in an emergency like this, where they know that something's being hijacked, you better believe they're going to fly at maximum speed. And these pilots are tremendous. I mean, they can intercept these things and slow down almost immediately, and there they are. And yet that never, ever happened.
When they did finally scramble jets, two F-15s were scrambled out of Otis Air Force Base, which is just south of Boston, Massachusetts. Okay. Their a typical top speed is 1,875 miles an hour. On that day, they flew an average of 447 miles per hour. You'll remember that the media at one point, their story was saying that these aircraft were flying somewhere near 700 miles an hour. In History Commons and in the terror timeline, there is a military liaison from the Boston Center that calls NORAD, and he tells them that this aircraft, which he thinks is Flight 11, is flying at 600 knots, that's 670 miles per hour, that he claims is a 767. The top speed is around 530 miles an hour. Hello, that should have gotten his attention, and air traffic controllers have reassured me that to even say those words would have made himself think, what the heck did I just say? That can't be a 767. So there were also two F-16s that were scrambled out of Langley, Virginia. Now, if you're not familiar with Washington, D.C. and how close Langley, Virginia is to the Pentagon, take a look on a Google map, because those two F-16s were scrambled. Again, they fly at about 1,500 miles an hour. On that day, they were kept at 410 miles an hour.
So that's kind of like an ambulance going to a wreck in first gear.
Exactly, with no lights and siren. So why? You have to ask yourself. I mean, this is a huge anomaly. Now, as a flight attendant, as an airline professional, I've had a jet scrambled before, so I know how quick it can happen. And we were always trained, and we were always reassured that within 6 minutes we'd have one of these military jets scrambled for us. And these are the people that were supposed to help us. But you know, one of the things that I found really interesting that I followed up on are where the people that were in charge of NORAD and our military went after they retired. When one of them retired just about 3 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks after 9/11. So I'm going to kind of build that into this third book that I'm just finishing up now. So you can talk about it. And then when I do some shows after that book is out, we're going to talk about where a lot of the people that were actually in position to scramble jets and make them go 1,500 miles an hour. I mean, think about this. If you're sitting in an airplane that's hijacked, how would you feel to know that there's somebody running NORAD that didn't think your life and the other 50 or 80 people sitting there with you was important enough to have these guys put on the afterburners and go as fast as they should? Well, that's not a really very nice decision.
Do you suppose they knew that the planes couldn't be found because they were in hangars at Westover?
Yeah, I got a feeling.
Why do you need to go Mach 5?
Save that gas, right? Yeah, it's really interesting that the F-16s that were scrambled out of Otis, it took them 9.6 minutes to arrive in New York. And they drug their feet, and they made excuses why those pilots could not take off until they were reassured that it would be too late.
Well, I think you're getting a pretty good idea of what it was that Keane was saying in his response in the 9/11 Commission report, that the Pentagon and the FAA were basically driving him crazy with their, you know, BS.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very true. And when I read that, I have to honestly admit, I read it two or three times because I thought, here's the chairman of the 9/11 Commission writing in this report along with his co-writer, the vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission, and they're saying that the FAA and the Pentagon basically had made so many misstatements, that's a nice political way of saying they were lying, that they were considering an investigation. Of course, that would be politically incorrect. Because nobody really wants to look at what really happened, well, and I know why.
Nobody wanted to do the 9/11 Commission to begin with.
Yeah, well, they were going to put Henry Kissinger in charge, remember, originally. First off, Bush did not want any commission or any investigation.
That's why it took 4 years.
And it really did. It took almost 4 years before, and a lot of that came from, God bless him, the surviving family members, and these were people from families that were employees that were in the towers. And also, I think there were some of them that were on the aircraft as well. But these were the people that really pressured. And how can you possibly think for a minute? This was the largest terror attack on the contiguous in the United States ever in the history of our country. And it was the new, quote-unquote, according to the Project for New American Century, the new Pearl Harbor.
Well, it was bigger than Pearl Harbor.
It was. It was. It was the largest terror attack. And yet no one, including Dick Cheney, the vice president, President George W. Bush, no one in the Pentagon, no one in the White House, no one wanted anyone to investigate this huge terror attack on our soil. Why? You just have to go ahead. I'm going to repeat that for you while you digest this. It took almost 4 years of constant going at these guys by the surviving family members of people who were murdered on 9/11 to get an investigation going. And then they decided they'd put Henry Kissinger in charge. I'll just do a little Google search about Henry Kissinger if you don't know who he is. And then that didn't work. So they put some people in charge that were also associated with either the Kissinger Associates or the Bush crime family or, numerous other people. So the whole thing was just bogus as heck. And obviously, Thomas Keene in his book, I believe he published it in 2006. Obviously, he wanted us to know by that quote that, hey, we were being lied to. And so when I saw that and I started looking, I just kept thinking, you know, as an airline person, I trusted two people. I trusted two entities, the United States military and the FAA. The FAA is kind of like our police. They rule on whether an aircraft is safe. When we bring a new aircraft online, for example, there's a group of flight attendants, and you can do this if you're a flight attendant, that go to FAA established areas where we will evacuate the aircraft and have fake passengers, and we'll have an aircraft, and we'll blow all the chutes and try to get people out of there and meet a time limit. It's the FAA that sets that. They set the minimum crew, whether you can fly an aircraft with five or you need seven crew members. If the aircraft is full, how many passengers per each one of us flight attendants do we think, does the FAA think, we can get off the aircraft safely if something happens on the ground, if there's a crash? So we drill for those, and we have the police are really the FAA, and they're the ones that certify an aircraft that it's safe to fly. They're the ones that create a minimum crew for an airplane, so you can be one flight attendant for 56 people, because over these drills that people have done, now these are people that know they're going to be evacuating or pretending to evacuate from something, so they're on the go. They already know they're being part of this. So, but that's how we collectively as airlines set these things, and it's all set through the FAA. Now, the FAA would travel sometime, and they also monitor air traffic controllers before the PATCO strike, when they were just regular people and they weren't military and they were off on a different union thing. But these air traffic or FAA people, they would travel along and they would come in and drill us on our particular aircraft. Let's say you're flying on a 757. Someone would come in, they'd show you an airline or FAA ID, and they would be considered inspectors of the flight crews. And so they would either be inspecting us or the pilots, and sometimes they would sit in the cockpit in the extra jump seat and monitor the pilots were doing things that the FAA mandated them to do. And the FAA also mandated us to carry certain things. We had to carry a cockpit key. We had to carry a manual, flight manual, that has all the emergency equipment on every aircraft that the company has. We had to carry certain things like a flashlight, had to have it and it had to work. So they would come in and they would check all of our equipment that we were traveling with. This is stuff we have to carry in our purse or in our suitcase wherever we go when we're in uniform and when we're on a trip. And then they would quiz us on the location for the oxygen bottles for if somebody needed oxygen, for the fire extinguishers, how certain exits would work and that sort of thing. So they were kind of like our police force. When I read that from Thomas Keene, I was like, wait a minute. These are the two entities that are supposed to save us and our passengers. And he's sitting here saying that they basically were lying to the 9/11 Commission. I mean, it got my attention so bad that I just had to keep digging to see why would he say that. And so these anomalies we're talking about are the reasons, and this is something, I'm not the only one that's found these anomalies. I'm not saying I'm the only person. I mean, these anomalies are well out there all over the Internet. Google search anomalies, 9/11.
Well, as long as we're talking about military and the FAA police, let's kind of talk about the protection aspects of the Pentagon. Now, the Pentagon is supposedly the most protected building in the world, and for good reason. It needs to be. I mean, if we're in a war situation, this is where all the planning and all the deployment is done from, and so it needs to be protected. And yet, there was no protection. Now, I know that shortly after you released your book, you got information from somebody that, you know, you can't really go into great detail, but you can give the indication as to what it was that happened.
Yeah, I can. This is really, actually, it's hard to spit this one out. People were called up by those in charge in the Pentagon that had more than one safety security ring around it. There were three or more. And they were called up to basically hit the switch and turn off the security that kept the Pentagon the most secure building in the entire world. And so not only do we have restricted airspace over Washington, D.C. area that they flew through, no problem, but nothing works, no Patriot missiles, none of the really serious security to protect that building was working that day.
Which makes perfect sense, because we do know that the Pentagon was hit. It just wasn't hit with an airplane.
That's correct.
And in order for it to be hit by what we think and what you're going to reveal in your next book, that security information and that security basically fencing had to be turned off.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, if people understand how connected that whole area is, for instance, Andrews Air Force Base, which is, also has jets to scramble, is only 11 miles from the Pentagon. I mean, this is all real close-in stuff. When you go back there, if you haven't been back there, it is definitely worth going. And go visit and just see how close everything is. I mean, you can get on one of those metro sub-train kind of things they have over there. I think they call it the metro. Right there near the Pentagon and get out at the White House or at the Capitol. I mean, it's pretty easy to get around.
I think the acronym is Federal Area Rapid Transit. Take that, FART.
Well, that could be. But, it's really interesting. And then, of course, Flight 77, you know, the 270-degree corkscrew turn at Mach 4 or something crazy thing, going faster than the aircraft could travel. And I do remember before I retired from flying in 2004, that having conversations with guys that were flying the 757, and I know that they had been A4 and Top Gun. One guy was a Blue Angel pilot, so these guys had been flying some real hot aircraft in their days, and landing on aircraft carriers and that sort of thing. Now they're sitting at the 757 in the right or the left-hand seat, having a conversation with several pilots about how the official story claimed that Flight 77 came in and did this 270-degree corkscrew turn and then landed into the Pentagon at the first floor when you've got these gigantic, and I can't recall if they're 8 or 9 feet in diameter, engines, two of them. They're 40 feet away, I believe, from each other. But they dangle off the wings. So if they came in with no landing gear, obviously we had to have done that, or we'd have seen the wheel marks on the grass, and we would have seen the jet marks on the grass. Because in order for it to hit the first floor, which is where the fire was originally, if you look at those first pictures, you can see it. It was impossible. And not only was it impossible, but we had this guy, Hani Hanjour, who was supposedly, now I don't know how the United States government cooks up this crazy story, but Hani Hanjour couldn't even fly a Cessna. He'd already flunked flying lessons more than once, and he had no ability to fly whatsoever. So we're led to believe that these guys could get in the cockpit of a 757 and fly it to a point where a Top Gun Blue Angel pilot said he couldn't have done that with that aircraft, because that aircraft is not a fighter plane. It is not designed like that. It's long. It's skinny. It's got a long wingspan. It's aeronautically impossible for, but collectively we're supposed to forget that logic. Put it in your back pocket. Don't look at it. Don't pull it out again.
Now, I've actually had the opportunity to fly a 737 simulator.
737.
Yeah, which, you know, is a little different, but I mean, it's still basically a two-engine jet. And I have to tell you that takeoff and flying isn't all that hard. But landing is a real pain in the butt. I mean, you really, truly have to know what you're doing. And to be able to do something like that without any experience is just absolutely impossible. I mean, I remember the first time I flew this simulator and came in for a landing, I absolutely shut down the simulation because I basically crash landed it.
Right. So you don't believe Hani Hanjour, who couldn't fly a Cessna in several lessons, could have got on and done that, right?
No. No.
So you have a little appreciation for exactly how difficult that would be for
Hani Hanjour. And I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one that had problems with it that was in the simulation. I mean, it was just an opportunity that, you know, me and a couple of friends had that we took advantage of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of these guys were actually small pilots. I mean, they knew how to fly Cessnas and those kinds of things. So they weren't, you know, completely inept like I was, but they had the same problem. I mean, they basically crash landed the plane, you know, as they get close to the ground, and game over, simulator stops. Well, unfortunately, that's not how it works in real life, but way could those pilots have done that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And there's just more and more information that's coming forward now. And, you know, I'm really grateful for all the people that were in positions at the time, that they have either come forward to help me, or and some of them still are coming forward to help me read through the terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data, who were maybe air traffic controllers, who were in the military, who were, and I get email a lot from people that are saying, this is my credentials, how can I help you? I was here on this day, this is what I know. And so when I see these things, and I am so grateful that I'm not the only one that's really putting their life on the line for getting this truth out. One of the reasons I want to get as many of these YouTubes out is so that if anything does happen to me, that the truth is out there. The same with the books. Before I released Methodical Illusion, I had 2 years to sit and think about, do I want to make this public? After Methodical Illusion, I had so many people come forward and share information, all the terabyte of, nearly a full terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data came forward. And other people came forward to help read that stuff and to help find out what it was that hit the Pentagon, because everyone knows no aircraft hit it. I will never forget watching this, because I was home and I started watching the whole thing on TV. And I remember Jamie McIntyre from CNN saying, no aircraft hit the Pentagon. There's been an explosion, but no aircraft hit the Pentagon. And I was looking at those first, I don't know, they maybe got rid of a lot of the film, the videos from there, because he was not that far away. But there was no sign of a crash there. And most people that have looked at airplane crashes, hey, here's a great crash you can look at. The Fly Dubai aircraft that crashed in Russia, it came down very similarly the 757, Flight 93. It came down. You can see it on security cameras. It's got the lights on it, so you can see how fast it was coming down and hit the ground. And you can also take a look at all of the airplane parts that were scattered all over the ground. And that's what you'd expect. and that's normal. Airplanes cannot crash into ground and just disappear into a gully like we saw at Shanksville. That's impossible. So people know that, and I know that we had to collectively turn our brains off. And part of the reason I think that the media showed things like the airplane going in through the South Tower like a hot knife through butter over and over again is so that we would believe that's possible. Another thing that's totally impossible is on the Pentagon. Remember, they claimed that this aircraft coming in at the 270-degree corkscrew turn and somehow managed to hit the first floor and not drag the jets that are 8 or 9 feet in diameter hanging off the wings on the grass. There's no sign of that. But on its way to hitting the Pentagon, it took down, I think the official story is 5 metal highway light posts with their wings. And I'm here to tell you, the wings are the fuel tanks. The wings are basically hollow, full of fuel. And if you hit anything, including a bird, with your wing, let alone a highway, one of those big, chrome or silver-looking lamps, and they have a big hook and they hang over the freeway. You've seen them. You can see them all around the Pentagon. If you struck one of those with your wings, and this supposedly, I believe, the official story says 5 of them came down, there would be no wings and no engines left, and it would be one giant explosion right where that first light post was struck, and that's where that airplane would have pretty much landed on the grass between the light post and the Pentagon if it were an airplane.
That brings up a whole nother issue. Now, we've got a lot of information that we're not obviously going to get to in this show, so we'll do more shows. But there were lots of videotapes taken of whatever it was that came in. Assuming that it really was a 757, there were would have been videotapes from surrounding businesses and surrounding buildings that would have videotaped that and would have shown us exactly what happened. Have you ever seen one of those?
There were over 85 closed circuit video security cameras on or around the Pentagon. And within 30 minutes, the FBI was at all of the surrounding hotels, gas station, mini markets, etc., all of the businesses, and confiscated all of their security cameras. They have been sealed. If you look even at pictures of the Pentagon, where it shows the collapse supposedly that they caused later on after the fires and stuff. But when you look at those pictures or any picture of the Pentagon, you can see the closed circuit security cameras, and they're probably every, it looks like they might be every 8 to 10 feet or so.
Well, another interesting aspect is, if they tried to pull something like this off today, everybody has got an iPhone and there'd be so many videos of what happened that they wouldn't be able to do it. But in 2001, they had phones like I have now.
Yeah, that's true. I know you've got an antique phone. It's kind of fun. But yeah, that's very, very true. And then another thing that really bothered me when I started looking into the Pentagon is that a lot of people that were inside the Pentagon, even near the hole supposedly and helping pull people out, and that came running from other places, almost all of them reported smelling cordite. And I'm here to tell you that there is no cordite involved in a commercial airplane crash at all. Cordite is an explosive that's used in missiles.
Well, yeah, what's interesting is people in the Pentagon would know that smell.
Yes, they would.
You know, if they hit my building, I wouldn't know cordite from, asbestos or from creosote.
Yeah.
But people in the Pentagon,
once you smell cordite, you never forget that smell. Mm-hmm. And anybody that's been in the military, that's been around missiles and those type of armaments that use the cordite, they knew, and a lot of them have come forward and claimed that.
But really, the best of all of this is the person that you ran into that was actually there that day, that came out of the building to help pull out dead bodies, because he had spent most of his military career dealing with that kind of stuff, and he knew how to deal with it. And when I asked him, that wasn't an airplane, was it? He said, looked me in the eye and said, "No, sir, it was not."
Yes, and when you have an eyewitness like that that has no reason to lie, and that was really at the start of my, really that started my afterburners, I guess, into this investigation. When I had a special operations, very well qualified, 25, 27, 30 year, I forget how long he'd been in the military, but highly qualified guy, happened to be in the Pentagon that day, and I happened to run into him. Just as I was starting to look into this and thinking about putting this information into some kind of book, at the time I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but once I found out, and if you've read The Methodical Illusion, I created a fictional character named Gary Gill. That's not his real name, but the conversation is real. And it was such a mind-blowing thing to have someone that was actually there confirm to me that there was no 757 there. I was standing there. I was helping pull people out. Who he was pulling out of the building were the people that were victims of the multiple explosions that went off near the Army Audit Office and the Office of Naval Intelligence, which is where the missing $2.3 trillion investigations were going on, both those offices. They were not next to each other either.
Now, for me, you know, I wanted to believe the official story. I mean, I just wanted to believe that. And it was really this conversation with this special services or special forces soldier that really started me on the path of realizing that I had been lied to.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was clear to me that this guy was not lying to me.
That's true. Yeah, he's the kind of guy that upon first meeting that you know that if somebody's harassing you, you've got a bodyguard. All you got to do is pick up the phone. Absolute incredible. This is real true patriotic hero that has been involved in everything for the last 30 years that our military basically has been involved in, and some of our intelligence as well. So yeah, that was a real eye opener, and for me, like I said, it really gave me that rocket booster to get me going to find out as many details as I could, and then to figure out a way to put it into some digestible format, in which, you know, I chose to use novels. And you know, every day I get emails from someone. I got the coolest, I got to print this out so I can read this in one of the next shows. I got the coolest thank you from a fifth grader who used my books to do his project for his fifth grade class was 9/11. And he read both of a Methodical Illusion and Methodical Deception. I don't know if his parents had bought them. I don't know how he found out about it. I don't know if he maybe found a YouTube. I don't know. But he just wrote to me and thanked me for all of the incredible information. This is a fifth grader. And then I got a really nice email just yesterday from Jerusalem, Israel, from someone thanking me for getting the truth out. And again,
it wasn't BB, was it?
No. You know, I get emails from people all the time that are just praying for my safety, and I do appreciate that, because at this particular time, with all of the trolls that have attacked and have tried to figure out who I am, where I am, what's going on with me, my bra size, what I eat, how do I drink my coffee, and everything else, and making up what they can't find, yes, indeed, my life is in danger. So I am hoping to have this third book out sometime the end of April, 1st of May, and I apologize for being so late. I was probably down in bed for almost 5 weeks, pretty much not sure if I was going to live long enough to get this next book out. So, well, we have lots more anomalies. I think we could probably do two more shows on the anomalies that we have. So we're going to talk about those. It gives you something to think about. And, you know, take notes and go look up stuff. But do be careful. There's a lot of blogs and mostly YouTubes that are really not dependable. So, you know, I encourage you, if you have any questions, you're welcome to email me through Rebecca at methodicalillusion.com, through methodicalillusion.com, methodicaldeception, or RebeccaRoth.com. And those will be in the description on the YouTube when we get that done. So looks like we're about running out of time. I can't believe it, because I know there is tons more stuff to talk about. I guess we'll do that next week.
Well, that'll be fun, because this has been a good show. I've enjoyed this. Because I got to talk a little.
Yeah. Well, if you're paying you M&Ms here, right? Have
well,
a big
you know.
Giant bag of Easter-colored ones. Is that that's going to be okay for you?
I'll get by. I'll get by.
All right. Well, I guess we'll just continue this in the Anomalies Part 2 next week, and then maybe we'll have Part 3 and 4. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. And, you know, I want this to be out there so you all can think about this because, hey, listen, if Thomas Keene thought the Pentagon and the FAA were lying, who are we to say they weren't, right?
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us at the Rebecca Roth Show. Ramjet.
Bye-bye.